I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the husband and wife team who shared the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics for work devoted to eradicating poverty. Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee embrace an experimental approach to developmental economics, using the kind of randomized controlled trials familiar to medical scientists to put ideas about human economic behavior to the test in real-world conditions. These trials have led to some new ideas about what's needed to help people prosper. The pair say yes to immigration and no to a universal basic income. And on the question of free trade, it's complicated. Our conversation starts after a short break. Traditional economic theory was built to describe a species you could call Homo economicus, capable of an unlimited series of rational, self-interested choices that will maximize material wealth and security. Take labor mobility. Free trade kills factory jobs. Homo economicus is always ready to pack up and move to a place that's hiring. But for the rest of us, it's not so easy, is it? We have friends and family around. We hate the weather in that other place. We're still depressed about being laid off and can't find the motivation. Real lives are complicated, and while money matters to us, there are lots of things we care about that influence our behavior at work and in markets. So to get economic theory right, this year's Nobel Prize winners in economics have developed a radical idea: run real-world controlled experiments to test out ideas for helping poor people attain a decent standard of living. The results have sometimes been very surprising. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests today, who shared that Nobel Prize with Michael Kremer, are here to talk about their work. Esther Duflo is Abdul Latif Jameel Professor of Poverty Alleviation and Development Economics at MIT. Abhijit Banerjee is Ford Foundation International Professor of Economics at MIT. They've co-authored a new book called Good Economics for Hard Times. And as it happens, they are partners not only in economics, but in life. They're married to each other. They join us today from WGBH in Boston. Welcome, both of you, to Think.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What is the right mix for economists between an understanding of mathematics and an understanding of behavioral psychology?
I don't think those are substitutes. I think they are complements. I think you have to figure out why people are behaving the way they are, and sometimes that has implications which are not obvious. And what the mathematics does is, in a sense, allow you to be relatively careful in saying, well, if I believe this and I believe that, then what else do I believe? That's what mathematics is handy for. It's a way of connecting the dots. And so first you have to have the right hypothesis, and you have to test them using these controlled trials and kind of figure out whether you believe, you know, the facts you believe are really the facts that are there on the ground. After that, you may want to use mathematics to triangulate them.
So explain that experimental approach to this work. What's involved in setting up randomized controlled trials to test ideas, for example, for ensuring that poor people have everything they need?
So the idea is very similar to the idea of testing drugs in medicine. So when you want to test a new drug, you take a sample of people and then you give half of them the status quo drug, the existing drug, and the other half the new drug that you hope will work better. And here the idea is very much the same. So you take, say you want to test a new approach to encourage people to get immunization for their children. You think that, for example, getting members of their community to remind them regularly to get immunization would be an effective thing to do, then you're going to take a number of villages, randomly implement the new program in half of them, randomly selected, and then in the other half, not implement that program, do your business as usual, and then after about a year, compare the immunization rates in the two kinds of villages.
Your selection to receive the Nobel Prize has been described as putting development economics back on center stage. To the extent that you agree that's true, why had it fallen out of fashion, development economics, starting in the 80s?
It's an excellent question. I mean, in some ways, I find it baffling, because you would imagine that, you know, if you are an economist, how could it not be central to think about the poorest people on the globe? It seems almost inexplicable. But I would say that somewhat happened was that there was this idea that all economics is kind of the same, and all economics is macroeconomics. And if you put those two ideas together, then we might as well study macroeconomics. We just have to get the exchange rate right, and have free markets, and whatever free markets means. But there was a set of ideological and sometimes, relatively unthought out moves, which constituted saying we have it all down. It's just down to doing macro right, or some version of thinking about, once we get the exchange rate right and the monetary policy right and the fiscal policy right, and not run too far a deficit and let free markets do their job, we're going to get there. And if we don't do that, we won't. And then, of course, what happened was a little bit that agenda was implemented kind of ruthlessly in Latin America in the 1980s and 90s, and also in the various emerging markets from the Soviet bloc. And there were a bunch of disasters. And I think that sort of started to maybe wake up people to the fact that that narrative, which sounded plausible enough to people, wasn't enough.
Is it fair to say the ultimate objective of your work goes beyond understanding how economics works and lands on a desire to actually change the way the world works?
Absolutely. And we see the two as integrated. Mm. We see that the only way to meaningfully help people is to understand what are the real barriers for them to achieve, the best life that they could have. And we think that to inform policymaking, one needs to understand how people behave, one needs to put any intuition that you might have to the test, one needs to figure out what works, what doesn't work, and why. And conversely, once you do that, that is also going to give you much better understanding of how people behave and why they behave the way they are. And therefore, it's going to make you make progress on the science of it as well. So the two are very much intertwined.
It's important to note that actually the human race has made progress, right? In 1990, 36% of the world's population lived in extreme poverty. How have global poverty rates changed since then?
They've fallen very substantially, partly thanks to the fact that India and China have both grown, and these were big countries with lots of poor people. But also, I think, in other places, and more importantly, all kinds of other things have improved. And these have improved even in places where, the growth hasn't been spectacular, in the poorest countries of the world. Infant mortality has fallen. Infant mortality was twice what it is now in 1990. That's a stunning fact in a sense. It's like, it's really like many, many less children are dying. And that's a fact that is mostly a fact from the poorest countries of the world. So it's not a fact about just India and China. It's really a fact about the whole world and poor countries and how, despite appearances, progress is happening and happening in the most surprising places.
Your work has emphasized taking into consideration what people care about besides the raw dollars and cents realities of jobs and markets and mobility. How do you account for likes, wants, and needs in economic theory? Can you write equations for these things?
You can always write equations, but the equations are helpful is a separate question. So I think economic theory is actually very helpful in some abstract way for thinking about it. Because it's sort of, for example, gives you a kind of a way to, pin down what exactly are you talking about. And sometimes what's useful is to say that, look, if people have these kinds of preferences, that means they'll do this thing. And that's sometimes not obvious, but then you test it and you find that, in fact, they don't. I'll give you an example. One kind of almost basic premise of a lot of economic theory coming out of some simple math doing under particularly specific behavioral assumptions, is that if you give poor people money, they're going to become lazy. There's that sort of Victorian idea, but it's one that's kind of built on foundations which are kind of very fundamental to economics. And now we've done lots of tests on that, and for the most part, we don't find it. I would say very categorically, there's lots of large-scale randomized controlled trials where poor people are given a substantial amount of money, and then we look at what's happening, or assets, and then we look at what's happening to the amount of hours they work or whether they're working or not. And for the most part, we just don't find this fact. So that then makes us go back and think, what went wrong when we wrote down that very simple equation which gave us this prediction? And what goes wrong partly is that poor people are often, I think, depressed. And when you give them something, they feel, okay, maybe my life doesn't suck as much as I thought it I did. And therefore, maybe it's worth, trying a little harder. So in fact, you have a countervailing effect, which comes from sort of feeling supported, feeling less abandoned, feeling less depressed, feeling less hopeless.
All right, I want to talk about immigration, which is an almost radioactive topic today in the United States and many other parts of the world. Lots of people are worried that low-skilled migrants take jobs from low-skilled native-born workers. You discovered something very different.
Well, actually, we didn't discover it. This is very much a finding that exists in the economics literature that has accumulated over the years, where study after study after study finds that when a vast movement of migrants in a city doesn't really affect the wage of the native worker, of low-skilled migrant. When low-skilled migrants come, even in large numbers, that doesn't seem to have any meaningful impact on the wage of the low-skilled workers. And people have it is pretty natural that people should have this intuition, because you think, more bodies, fewer jobs, or at least more bodies, lower wages. So I think that's why people feel so strongly that it has to be true. So what we do in the book is not only show, well, it happens not to be true, examples after example after example. For example, the one of the most famous people looks at what happened when people from Cuba came in large number to Miami, and compared the wages in Miami to the wages in other cities of similar cities to Miami, and found absolutely no difference in the wages of the Miami native workers. So, but just telling the fact might not be sufficient, because if it really goes against your strong intuition, then you need an explanation for why you didn't get it right. So what we are trying to explain is various reasons why, in fact, this basic intuition might not hold. One simple reason is that migrants are also consumers. So when they come in, not only they come in to work, but they come in and they come in with their pocketbooks and they spend their salary. And in particular, they spend the salaries mostly on goods that are produced by other low-skilled workers. So at the same time as they produce more bodies, they also produce more consumers, and the two effect cancels. And there are also other differences that are coming from the fact, for example, that employers react to the fact that they have a bunch of migrants who are willing, frankly, to take jobs that no native worker wants to take on. So if the migrants are available, they hire the migrants. But when the migrants are not available, then they don't really find a native worker to replace them. So instead, they mechanize, or they move their production offshore, or they do something else. And therefore, the job that is taken from a migrant doesn't go to a native worker. It just vanishes.
My guests this hour are the winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics for their work on alleviating poverty. They are Esther Duflo, Abdul Latif Jamil, Professor of Poverty Alleviation and Development Economics at MIT, and Abhijit Banerjee, Ford Foundation International Professor of Economics at MIT. Their new book is called Good Economics for Hard Times. We'll come back to this conversation in 2 minutes. You're You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guests this hour are both economists at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Abhijit Banerjee and Esther Duflo. Last month, they were awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics for their experimental approach to alleviating poverty, and they have a new book out called Good Economics for Hard Times. We've talked about unskilled immigrants who are often considered unwelcome in their destination communities. On the other hand, President Trump and many other political leaders have been far more welcoming to highly educated immigrants. What is their effect on the new countries they move to?
Interestingly, the evidence on, because partly of the politics of the situation, people haven't studied that. When somebody actually did, they studied the effect of importing nurses into the U.S., you find that there is a substantial negative effect on the earnings of nurses when foreign nurses are brought in. That seems quite different from the effects of low-skill immigrants, perhaps because, for the reason we mentioned already, a lot of low-skill migrants take jobs that the native population doesn't want to take, whereas nurses just take jobs from nurses. It should be studied more, actually. It's an interesting and kind of understudied area, but it seems like that's where, if you want to worry about who are the migrants who lower wages, it seems to be more the higher-skilled migrants.
If moving to a more prosperous place is good for individual migrants, why don't more people do it?
I think people often like being where they are. Mm-hmm. People like to live with their family and have a position in a social network and maybe a job they like and a life they like. And therefore, the pool of a higher wage elsewhere is not strong enough for most people to want to uproot themselves to do that. So as a result, the people who are willing to migrate internationally are either people who are remarkably enterprising, which is why you see often that many of the entrepreneurs in the US have migrant roots, or are people who are pushed by some clear adversity. Like, for example, we saw an increase in the number of migrants and refugees in the aftermath of the Syrian crisis. This is very much the same thing that we observe within countries. For example, the Census Bureau just released yesterday or a couple of days ago the rate of mobility within the US, and they are as low as they have ever been. And they are about half of what they were in the 1950s. So every year, around 3% of people actually leave a county to move to another county, which is very, very little in comparison to what it was.
So when an area starts to draw increasing numbers of high-wage workers, a place like Silicon Valley, what happens that causes low-skilled workers to be unable to afford to follow them?
Well, I mean, I guess that's a constitutes a leading question.
Okay, fair enough.
I mean, what happens is real estate prices go through the ceiling. The prices of most amenities go through the ceilings. You know, your McDonald's closes and the fancy coffee place, which has a $5 cappuccino, sets up in its place. And I think the standard of living for low wage workers is often, goes down. And this is sort of what is, I think, creating so much unhappiness in a place like San Francisco, where this has been happening for a long time. And every area that used to be kind of where the low wage people could have a toehold is sort of being turned into another upper middle class community, and I think that's obviously generating lots of unhappiness.
Does a city or a community, a metropolitan area that is composed almost exclusively of very wealthy people, ultimately become unsustainable?
I think that's a hard question, because we haven't quite seen that. What happens in Latin America, which I'm not saying will happen here, is that it turns into a kind of a, it turns into completely segregated pieces where, you know, the gated communities show up because the people outside so resent the people inside. And that was the very much what you see in Latin America, you see it in the Philippines, you see it in a bunch of places where inequality has played out kind of dramatically and within urban spaces. And that's the result of that is, you know, this very clear rules of exclusion and violence and fear of the other, you know, especially the low wage other or low income other, you know, the favelas of Rio. That's one shape of a very unequal city where, you know, the basically some areas are now out of bounds for, you know, middle class people or upper middle class people. They're scared of going there, and on the other side, the life quality of lives within those communities is low because there's lots of violence there.
And then one thing that happens is relates to the conversation we are having about international migration before. One thing that people have observed is that the migrants, once they come in, have a high rate of intergenerational mobility than the local workers. So they come in extremely poor, but their children actually do well. And one of the reasons why their children actually do well is that the migrants settle in places which are better for intergenerational mobility, where schools are better, where the infrastructure for allowing people to get an education and move on are better. And one of the reasons why it's the migrants who move there is because they are willing to support conditions of lives that the native workers are just not willing to support. So, for example, if you look at Palo Alto and you want to work in Palo Alto, say as a maid, you're going to have to commute maybe 2 hours if you want to be able to afford the the real estate where you
a
can
nice
live.
House somewhere. Yeah.
So, as a result, people will. That's something that for most people who live in less good places is just, you know, contributes to them not wanting to move there, and so the lack of ability to live in the places where there are jobs opportunities, either direct, highly skilled opportunity or as, you know, service industry for the high-skilled workers is also one reason why people aren't willing to go there and why international migrants might be willing to go there and do it.
All right, I want to talk about trade. What are the pros and cons of protectionist trade policies designed to shield domestic producers of commodities from foreign competition?
Well, I don't know that there are any obvious pros. I think the point we make in the book is that the reason why trade is costly is because it hits a specific group. So when trade comes in, it hits a specific group. That group then gets kind of clobbered. So it's the furniture makers in North Carolina. They go out of business. They, for the reasons we already talked about, they don't leave. So they're, you know, they don't have an income. So all the other people who work there, the barbers and the you know, the people who fix the nails and the restaurant workers, they now are out of a living too, and the whole place collapses. In some sense, I think that what we know quite well is that when trade comes in, there's a transition, and in transition, a bunch of people get clobbered. Right now, if the U.S. were to become more protectionist, it's not that those places will come back. What's going to happen, because those places are really kind of so beyond the pale that they're not going to, most of them are not going to come back. The cities have fallen apart and, you know, the crime rates are high and they've been trying for a while to attract industry back. What's going to happen is some other places where, you know, the Chinese are going to have retaliatory tariffs and then, you know, the corn farmers in Iowa will be the next people to face a transition because they used to export and now they can't. And so it's not clear to me that protectionism is really the answer to the challenge of trade. It's more to use the fact that we know who the victims of trade are and to leverage that knowledge to start helping them from even before it happens. In a sense, we can predict. We can kind of predict where the next disaster is going to happen. And we don't do anything about it. It's sort of, it unfolds in slow motion. We watch it happen. The cities fall apart. We don't do anything about it. So I do think that the right way to think about trade is that we aren't doing enough to anticipate the possible problems it creates. Protectionism will create a new set of problems, at least at this point. If we move to more protectionism, I think it's going to create a new set of problems. And that new set of problems will then have to be solved because, you know, then it'll be the Iowa farmers who are complaining instead of the furniture workers in North Carolina. I think avoiding transitions, especially brutal transitions, is the way to go.
One suggestion you make is to revamp the Federal Trade Adjustment Assistance Program. What does the TAA do now, and how would you change or enhance it?
So what the TAA does now is give you the right to get extended unemployment insurance if your job is deemed to be to have disappeared because of trade. You get access to extended unemployment insurance, and you get access to tuition credit to be able to get training to move into another profession. And there is a study of this program that shows that for the people who benefit from it, it's actually quite effective. It really helped them get a job faster, get a better job faster, and over the next 10 years make more money than someone completely comparable who didn't get access to the program. The problem with the program is that it is much, much, much too small in terms of the number of people it covers. So right now, it is very difficult to be deemed eligible. It's really you have to convince someone, but the budget is just tiny. So the most affected counties, the counties that are most negatively affected by trade only get 57 cents of trade adjustment assistance per worker on average.
That is to say
nothing. I mean, it's just tiny, tiny, tiny. It's even, you know, an order of magnitude lower than disability payment, which is another way in which people survive when their county is affected by trade. So we make two recommendations, or perhaps three. The first one is to expand it, expand the coverage by increasing the budget, making sure that many more workers can get it. In fact, it could also be expanded beyond trade. You could think of it as a disruption assistance program, that if your job has disappeared because of automation, it's not your fault either, and it really causes the same number of issues. Or your job could be displaced because of regulation, for example, makes it unsustainable. So all of these reasons should be ground for eligibility for the program, which we would call, you know, a disruption assistance program. And the second thing we propose is that it be made more generous. In particular, it could be modeled around on the GI Bill, which is for the veterans of wars, which is more generous in terms of how many years it covers and also in terms of the university credit it gives you. So it really gives people access. Veterans, the GI Bill gives veterans access to a good high-class education. And we think that this should be really the same for the veterans of this disruption. The third thing that we propose, which is related, is to relabel it. It's not like... It shouldn't be seen as welfare. It shouldn't be seen as us being generous. It should be seen as compensating society's hero, in a way, for the price they paid in their lives and in the disruption in their life for absolutely no fault of their own on behalf of all of us. And in the same way that there is, I think, bipartisan support to help the veterans of wars, there should be bipartisan support to help the veterans of trade and technological disruption.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How is the United States economy affected by Chinese trade policy, and particularly by China's longstanding practice of manipulating currency values to make their goods artificially cheap?
Well, I think that there's clear evidence that led to pockets of of misery in the U.S. I think it's clear that we kind of didn't. It's not so. Let me say two things. One is that, unlike sometimes what people predict, which is that, you know, if you open to trade, China will produce everything. That, of course, never happened, because, and it cannot happen. In a sense, if China is selling us everything, what are we buying it with? So I think what did happen is that there were winners and losers. The winners seemed to live on the two coasts and in some other specific pockets, and the losers live everywhere else and are in, again, in specific pockets. We could predict which are the areas that would get hurt most, but there were a lot of losers, relatively low income people who lost their jobs, and there were some winners who were lived in on both coasts and who could leverage the fact that they could have cheaper manufacturing to, for example, you know, expand their retail businesses, or alternatively, and then we were all winners in a sense. You know, we get our shirts cheaper and our whatever, our electronics cheaper, and our even some of our food cheaper because of this. And so it's really a matter of there being quite distinct groups of winners and losers. Mostly a lot of winners who win a little bit, because there are people like me who don't really need the help but who get cheaper clothes. And then are some very concentrated group of losers who are sort of these places which so many people now write about, in the Appalachia, in the South, in the Midwest, in the Upper Midwest, where factories just closed. And when factories closed, whole lives and lifestyles fell apart.
The huge mistake that was done in policy, probably with the, you know, in some sense, the...
Esther, excuse me for interrupting. Let me stop you because we have to take a break, and I want to make sure that you have time to make that point. So we'll come back in just a minute with Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee, co-winners of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics. You're listening to Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today with two recipients of the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics, Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. Both are economists at MIT. They've also co-authored a new book called Good Economics for Hard Times. Esther, before the break, you were going to follow up on Abhijit's comments about Chinese currency manipulation and trade practice.
Yes, so what Abhijit emphasizes is the fact that there are diffuse gains, like everybody pays a little bit less for their shirts. There are also some concentrated gains on the people who own the capital and the firms that are doing much better out of cheaper manufacturing goods from China. And then there are very concentrated losses for people who happen to be producing the goods that are now being produced in China. And the big policy mistakes has been to assume that those who lost their job would pick up and go and take advantage of the opportunities elsewhere. And that to some extent it was their responsibility and that it would also just happen. And that is a mistake that has probably been fueled and enabled by economist as a profession, in a way, because as a profession, we tend to believe that this is what people would do, that they would be attracted by the higher wages they could get somewhere else and go. And as we were discussing, this just happens to not be true. And that has really misled us and misled the policymakers in the appropriate response to this situation.
Lately, many people have been talking about whether something like a universal basic income might alleviate many of the worst effects of poverty. You remind us here that our jobs provide us with a lot more than a paycheck. So how does that affect the way we should think about a UBI?
I mean, it's UBI doesn't provide a job. And then I think the vision of UBI is very much that, you don't need a job. You can just participate in the gig economy. You can whatever, paint in the morning, drive an Uber in the afternoon, and play jazz in the evening. That's kind of the Silicon Valley version of what in the new world will be. Everybody will be in the gig economy. The problem is people actually, there's no clear evidence that that's what people want. I mean, they seem to like to have a steady job where they have colleagues, they meet people. That's their life in a sense. It's an entire, so, you know, sitting at home playing jazz. I mean, maybe there is a different world where that would be the right response, but it's not that we are close to that. And I'm not sure that we should imagine that's going to be the easy way out of this quandary that we are going to be possibly in when automation takes a lot of jobs away, is that, you know, we'll just pay people to enough to live on, and then they're going to find meaning in their lives on their own. I'm not sure that that's obvious at all. But I think there's a separate problem, which is that I think that a separate possibility, which is that I think that precisely because we know who the victims are, it seems a bit given, and given that, you know, the taxpayers are not infinitely generous, there's a certain fixed budget, and you can either give everybody, you know, whatever, $12,000 a year, or you can give some people $50,000 right now because they need $50,000 to make their life whole. They, you know, get a new skill, learn a new skill, and also while supporting their, you know, their family, and, you know, not losing their house, and all of that means that I think concentrating the benefits there's an attractive argument for concentrating the benefits, that we know who the victims are. Let's first order, the people who really need to be made whole are the people who are kind of going to be, you know, the victims of various disruptions. So let's focus on the disruptions and their victims rather than try to make it universal.
In Denmark, they do this thing that is known as flexicurity. What is that exactly? How does it work?
Flexicurity is in some sense some generalized version of the program we were discussing before, of basically if you lose your job, you get access to unemployment insurance and generous opportunities to get training. So what happened in Denmark is that there are many people who transition in and out of unemployment. They transition really fast. And contrary to say, a country like France, where we don't have that system where if you get unemployed, you stay unemployed forever, or a country like the US, where people, you know, would do anything to avoid unemployment and will take bad jobs rather than be unemployed, or would exit the labor force altogether if they think that there is no meaningful job they can have. In Denmark, being unemployed is not the end of the world. It's just your, you know, a way station on the next, onto your next thing. And if it works in Denmark, then presumably it could work in other countries as well. It does cost money, because it does cost money to provide people meaningful chances to get training. But there are also experiments in the US showing that it can be very successful.
How can economics account for changes to the global economy that will happen as a result of climate change?
I mean, I think that we kind of know which are the places where, for example, agriculture is going to be hurt. We know where life will become impossible, which will create massive migration flows. If half of Bangladesh goes under the sea, that's Bangladesh has 200 million people. Mm. I mean, they'll have to go somewhere. So I think we know kind of where the most egregious problems are going to come up. Then there's some stuff that we actually, you know, there's interesting research happening right now, trying to understand what would be the responses of, you know, mitigating technologies. And I assume that there will be some response, that, you know, new technology will be developed so that even though the temperatures are 3 degrees higher, we can still grow whatever wheat and this or rice or whatever is going to be. Rice is the crop that people say will be most threatened, but we may be able to grow it elsewhere. But I think overall, I think what we can at best do is delineate the contours of the maybe the best case scenario and the worst case scenario. I don't think we have very good models for predicting the what's exactly going to happen. In the late Marty Weitzman, who was a Harvard professor who passed away last year, one of the great environmental economists of our time, made the point that in a sense we should just worry about the worst case scenarios, because those are really so much more morally repugnant than anything else. You know, the best case scenarios, if they happen, they're good. But the worst case scenarios will require us to sort of rethink what it means to be human.
On the bright side, economics also can help us think about how to avoid the worst case scenario. And in a sense, that's perhaps the most useful use of economics in the very, very short run now, is not to think, you know, what would happen if there was a much harder planet. It wouldn't be good. So let's try to think, what can we do here and now in order to avoid that? And we have a lot of indication that of what could help people, for example, slightly change their behavior. If everybody's changed their behavior a little bit, it might not be that costly for any individual person, but still make a big difference in the overall likelihood of a big climate catastrophe.
Beyond something like cap and trade, and I think most people are familiar with the essential idea behind that, how can economic theory be harnessed to motivate people to make those more sustainable consumption choices?
So one of the things that we also have learned in economics, but maybe we have kept it a little bit too much for ourselves, is that preferences are not like unmovable. They can be changed. And in particular, we are social creatures and we are creatures of habit. And both of these things can be harnessed to change people's behavior. So, for example, when you probably get in the mail this letter showing you the consumption, the energy consumption of your neighbors, and those letters actually are effective. They do when you find out that you are the least energy efficient of your entire neighbor, it makes you feel, you know, what could I do to be a little bit less bad. So that's the first thing, which is we respond to what other people are doing and we can be a little bit shamed into changing our behavior. And the second thing is that once you have changed your behavior, either because you've been shamed into doing it or for some period of time it was easier, then you kind of stick to those same habits. So once you learn to set up your thermostat a little bit less cool in the summer or hot in the winter, then you keep it that way. And once you learn to close the windows or to insulate your house or some such, then you continue with these habits, which is why people in Europe spend so much less energy than we do in the US and are not, we believe, unhappier for it. It's just because they have acquired the habit of putting one more sweater in the winter and wearing T-shirts in the summer, and they are fine with that.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How excited or how concerned should we be about the potential economic implications of artificial intelligence?
I think quite concerned. I mean, I think that the major disruptions in technology, I mean, the one that people often talk about is, you know, there was this, when mechanization first happens, with sort of external energy sources like, you know, the locomotive and all, and the spinning jenny and all that, and people say, well, you know, in the end, we were better off for it. But one fact that's sometimes less emphasized is that it took about 75 years for wages to recover from what they were to what they were just before the Industrial Revolution. The Industrial Revolution was kind of, in the long run, it panned out. In the short run, it was a bloody disaster for a bunch of people.
If you will indulge me in asking you a personal question, I'm curious, we'll remind people that you are married to one another. I'm curious about how you became a couple. I assume you were drawn together by shared professional interests, but maybe you met at a ballroom dancing class. I don't know.
No, it's much more boring than that, unfortunately. we met working together in the same workplace, and we knew each other for a long time before our relationship took another turn.
And are dinner table conversations a lot about economics, or do you try to avoid sort of bringing the office home with you?
Oh, we would love to talk about economics, but we have two little people who are very much opposed to this to this type of conversation.
And who dominate the conversation entirely. So,
Do you have, insights on, so many people are interested in teaching their children what they will need to know to make good habits as sort of consumers and workers in the world. Do you have thoughts on what a child's economic education should be?
I wish then I would impart it on the two little people in question. Mm. I do think that a little bit is known about what is beneficial for children in early childhood, and I think it's less economics than learning how to be social people and resilient people. Mm. So. Another thing that governments could do, in fact, is to make sure that all children have access to this type of education and to have access to high-quality early childhood and primary school education that involves not just content but also social skills. And there are plenty of studies that shows that social skills, such that the ability to understand other people's emotions, to engage with them, and grit and resilience are actually skills that help people throughout their life, not only in getting higher wages, but also in being resilient to shocks.
Esther Duflo is Abdul Latif Jamil Professor of Poverty Alleviation and Development Economics at MIT. Abhijit Banerjee is Ford Foundation International Professor of Economics at MIT. They were jointly awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Economics for their work on alleviating poverty. And they've got a new book out called Good Economics for Hard Times. Esther, Abhijit, it's been a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for making time for us.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Huge pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our handle is at KERA Think. You can subscribe to the Think podcast using whatever podcast app you like best. And if you want to know about shows we have planned coming up or check out the archive, go to our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.